Chapter 24. A Time for Iron. A dozen leagues east of Ebu Dar, Rakan glided in out of the cloud-streaked sunrise to land in a long pasture marked as the Flyer's Field, by colored streamers on tall poles. The brown grasses had been trampled and scored days since. All of the creature's grace in the air was lost as soon as their claws touched the ground in a lumbering run. Leathery pinions 30 paces or more wide held high as if the animal wanted to sweep itself back upward. There was little beauty, either, in the Rakan that ran awkwardly down the field, beating ribbed wings, Flyers crouching in the saddle as if to pull the beast up by main force, ran on until at last they stumbled into the air, wingtips barely clearing the tops of the olive trees at the end of the field. Only as they gained height and turned toward the sun, soared toward the clouds, did the Rakan regain dignified grandeur. Flyers who landed did not bother to dismount. While a groundling held a basket up for the Rakan to gulp whole shriveled fruits by the double handful at a time, one of the flyers would hand down their scouting report to a still more senior groundling, and the other bent on the other side to receive new orders from a flyer too senior to handle reins personally very often. Almost that quickly after coming to a halt, the creature was reined around to waddle over to where 4 or 5 others waited their turn to make that long, ungainly run to the sky. At a dead run, dodging between moving formations of cavalry and infantry, messengers carried the scouting reports to the huge red-bannered command tent. There were haughty Terrabanner lancers and stolid Amadisian pikemen in well-ordered squares, breastplates striped horizontally in the colors of the regiments they were attached to. Altaran light horse, in disordered bunches, made their mounts prance, vain of the red slashes crisscrossing their chests, so different from the markings anyone else wore. The Altarans did not know those indicated irregulars of doubtful reliability. Among the Shonchan soldiers, named regiments with proud honors were represented from every corner of the empire. Pale-eyed men from Alkam, honey-brown men from Enkon, men black as coal from Koweal and Dalinshar. There were Marat Torm, on their sinuous, bronze-scaled mounts that made horses whicker and dance in fright, and even a few Marat Grolm, with their squat, beak-mouthed charges. But one thing that always accompanied a Shonchan army was conspicuous by its absence. The Suldam and Damani were still in their tents. Captain General Kenamiraj thought of the Suldam and Damani a great deal. From his seat on the dais he could see the map table clearly, where helmetless under-lieutenants checked the reports and placed markers to represent the forces in the field. A small paper banner stood above each marker, inked symbols giving the size and composition of the force. Finding decent maps in these lands was next to impossible, but the map copied atop the large table was sufficient, and worrying in what it told him. Black disks for outposts overrun or dispersed. Far too many of those, dotting the whole eastern half of the Venir Range. Red wedges, for commands on the move, marked the western end as thickly, all pointed back toward Ebu Dar. And scattered among the black disks, 17 stark white. As he watched, a young officer in the brown and black of a Marat Torm carefully placed an 18th. Enemy forces. A few might be the same group seen twice, but for the most part, they were much too far apart, the timing of the sightings wrong. Along the walls of the tent, clerks in plain brown coats, marked only with insignia of rank among clerks on the wide collars, waited at their writing tables, pens in hand, for Miraj to issue orders that they would copy out for distribution. He had already given what orders he could. There were as many as 90,000 enemy soldiers in the mountains, nearly twice what he could muster here, even with the native levies. Too many for belief, except that scouts did not lie. Liars had their throats slit by their fellows. Too many, springing out of the ground like trapworms in the Sentajor. At least they had 100 miles of mountain yet to cover, if they intended to threaten Ebu Dar. Almost 200, for the white disks furthest east. And hill country after that for another 100 miles. Surely the enemy general could not mean to let his dispersed forces be confronted one by one. Gathering them together would take more time. Time alone was on his side right then. The entry flaps of the tent swept open, and the High Lady Suroth glided in, black hair a proud crest spilling down her back, pleated snow-white gown and richly embroidered overrobe somehow untouched by the mud outside. He had thought her still in Ebu Dar. She must have flown out by Torakin. She was accompanied by a small entourage, for her. A pair of Death Watch guards with black tassels on their sword hilts held the tent flaps, and more were visible outside. Stone-faced men in red and green. The embodiment of the Empress, might she live forever. Even the blood took note of them. Surath sailed past as if they were as much servants as the lushly bodied Dakavale, in slippers and a nearly transparent white robe, her honey-yellow hair in a multitude of thin braids, who carried the High Lady's gilded writing desk, a meek 2 paces behind. Surath's voice of the blood, Alwyn, a glowering woman in green robes, with the left side of her head shaved and the remainder of her pale brown hair in a severe braid, followed close on her mistress's heels. As Miraj stepped down from the dais, he realized with shock that the second Dakavale behind Surath, short and dark-haired and slim in her diaphanous robe, was Damani. A Damani garbed as property was unheard of, but odder still, it was Alwyn who led her by the Edam. He let none of his amazement show as he went to one knee, murmuring, "The light be upon the High Lady Surath. All honor to the High Lady Surath." Everyone else prostrated themselves on the canvas groundcloth, eyes down. Miraj was of the blood, if too low to shave the sides of his scalp like Surath. Only the nails of his little fingers were lacquered, much too low to register surprise if a High Lady allowed her voice to continue acting as Suldam after being raised to the Sojin. Strange times in a strange land, where the dragon reborn walked, and Marath Damani ran wild to kill and enslave where they would. Surath barely glanced at him before turning to study the map table, and if her black eyes tightened at what she saw, she had cause. Under her, the Hylene had done far more than had been dreamed, reclaiming great stretches of the stolen lands. All they had been sent for was to scout the way, and after Falma, some had thought even that impossible. She drummed fingers on the table irritably, the long blue-lacquered fingernails on the first two clicking. Continued success, and she might be able to shave her head entirely and paint a third nail on each hand. Adoption into the imperial family was not unheard of for achievements so great. And if she stepped too far, overstepped, she might find her fingernails clipped and herself stuffed into a filmy robe to serve one of the blood, if not sold to a farmer to help till his fields, or sweat in a warehouse. At worst, Miraj would only have to open his own veins. He continued to watch Surath in patient silence. But he had been a scout lieutenant, Morat Rakan, before being raised to the blood, and he could not help being aware of everything around him. A scout lived or died by what he saw, or did not, and so did others. The men lying on their faces around the tent, some hardly seemed to breathe. Surath should have taken him aside and let them continue with their work. A messenger was being turned back by the soldiers at the entrance. How dire was the message that the woman tried to push past Death Watch guards. The Dakavale with the writing desk in her arms caught his eye. Scowls flashed across her pretty doll's face, never pushed down for more than moments. Property showing anger? And there was something else. His gaze flickered to the Damani, who stood with her head down, but still looked around with curiosity. Brown-eyed Dakavale and pale-eyed Damani looked about as different as two women could, yet there was something about them, something in their faces. Strange. He could not have said how old either was. Quick as his glance was, Alwyn noticed. With a twitch of the Adam's silvery leash, she put the Damani face down on the groundcloth. Snapping her fingers, she pointed to the canvas with a hand not encumbered by the Adam's bracelet, then grimaced when the honey-haired Dakavale did not move. "Down, Leandrin," she hissed, almost under her breath. With a glare for Alwyn, a glare, the Dakavale sank to her knees, features painted with sulkiness. Most strange, but hardly important. Face impassive and otherwise bursting with impatience, he waited. Impatience and no little discomfort. He had been raised to the blood after riding 50 miles in a single night with 3 arrows in him to bring word of a rebel army marching on Shandar itself, and his back still pained him. Finally, Surath turned from the map table. She did not give him leave to rise, much less embrace him as one of the blood. Not that he had expected that. He was far beneath her. "You are ready to march?" she demanded curtly. At least she did not speak to him through her voice. Before so many of his officers, the shame would have put his eyes on the ground for months, if not years.
"I will, Sarath,"
he replied calmly, meeting her gaze. He was of the blood, however low.
"They cannot combine in fewer than 10 days, with at least another 10 before they can exit the mountains. Well before then, I—" "They could be here tomorrow," she snapped. "Today! If they come, Miraj, they will come by the ancient art of traveling, and it seems very possible that they will come."
He heard men shifting on their bellies before they could restrain themselves. Sarath lost control of her emotions and babbled of legends.
"Are you certain?"
The words popped out of his mouth before he could stop them. He had only thought she had lost control before. Her eyes blazed, she gripped the edges of her flower-worked robe, white-knuckled, and her hands shook.
"Do you question me?"
she snarled incredulously.
"Suffice it that I have my sources of information."
And was furious with them as much as with him, he realized.
"If they come, there will be perhaps as many as 50 of these grandly named Ashaman, but no more than 5,000 or 6,000 soldiers. It seems there have been no more since the beginning, whatever the flyers say."
Miraj nodded slowly. 5,000 men, moved about in some way with the One Power, would explain a great deal. What were her sources that she knew numbers so precisely? He was not fool enough to ask. She certainly had listeners and seekers in her service, watching her, too. 50 Ashaman. The very idea of a man channeling made him want to spit in disgust. Rumor claimed that they were being gathered from every nation by the Dragon Reborn, this Randalthor, but he had never expected there could be so many. The Dragon Reborn could channel, it was said. That might be true, but he was the Dragon Reborn. The prophecies of the dragon had been known in Shonchan even before Luther Payandrag began the consolidation. In corrupted form, it was said, much different from the pure version Luther Payandrag brought. Miraj had seen several volumes of the Kuriathon cycle printed in these lands, and they were corrupted too. Not one mentioned him serving the Crystal Throne, but the prophecies held men's minds and hearts still. More than a few hoped the return came soon, that these lands could be reclaimed before Tarmon Gaden, so the Dragon Reborn could win the last battle for the glory of the Empress, might she live forever. The Empress surely would want Althor sent to her, so she could see what sort of man served her. There would be no difficulty with Althor, once he had knelt to her. Few easily shook off the awe they felt, kneeling before the Crystal Throne, with the thirst to obey drying their tongues. But it seemed obvious that bundling the fellow onto a ship would be easier if disposing of the Ashaman. They had to be disposed of, certainly. Waited until Althor was well on his way across the Arath Ocean to Shandar. Which brought him back to the problem he had been trying to avoid, he realized with an inward start. He was not a man to shy from difficulties, much less ignore them blindly, but this was different from any he had faced before. He had fought in 2 dozen battles with Damani used on both sides. He knew the way of them. It was not only a matter of striking out with the power. Experienced Suldam could somehow see what Damani or Marath Damani did, and Damani would tell the others so they could defend as well. Could Suldam see what a man did, too?
Worse. "You will release the Suldam and Damani to me," he said.
Taking a deep breath in spite of himself, he added,
"If they're still sick, it will be a short fight and bloody on our side."
Which produced another stir among the men waiting on their faces. Every second rumor in the camp was about what illness had confined the Suldam and Damani to their tents. Alwyn reacted quite openly, most improper in a Sojin, with a furious glare. The Damani flinched again and began to shiver where she lay. Oddly, the honey-haired Dakavale flinched as well. Smiling, Siroth glided to where the Dakavali knelt. Why would she smile at a poorly trained serving girl? She began stroking the kneeling woman's thin braids, and a sullen pout appeared on that rosebud mouth. A former noblewoman of these lands? Siroth's first words supported that, though obviously meant for him.
Small failures bring small costs. Great failures bring painfully great costs. You will have the demani you require, Mirage, and you will teach these Ashaman they should have remained in the north. You will wipe them from the face of the earth. The Ashaman, the soldiers, all of them. To the man, Mirage, I have spoken.
It will be as you say, Siroth, he replied. They will be destroyed. To the man.
There was nothing else he could say now. He wished, though, that she had given him an answer about whether the Suldam and Damani were still sick. Rand reined Taidashar around near the crest of the bare stony hill to watch most of his small army spilling out of other holes in the air. He held hard to the true source, so hard it seemed to tremble in his grasp. With the power in him, the sharp points of the crown of swords pricking his temples felt at once keener than ever and utterly removed, the mid-morning chill both colder and beneath notice. The never-healing wounds in his side were a dull and distant ache. Luz Theron seemed to be panting in uncertainty, or perhaps fear. Maybe after coming so close to death the day before, he did not want so much to die anymore. But then, he did not always want to die. The only constant in the man was the desire to kill, which just happened to include killing himself often enough.
"They'll be killing enough for anybody soon," Rand thought. "Light, the last 6 days were enough to sicken a vulture."
Had it only been 6 days? The disgust did not touch him, though. He would not let it. Luz Theron did not answer. Yes. It was a time for iron hearts, and iron stomachs, too. He bent a moment to touch the long, cloth-wrapped package under his stirrup leather. No. Not time yet. Maybe not at all. Uncertainty shimmered across the void, and maybe something else. Not at all, he hoped. Uncertainty, yes, but the other half had not been fear. It had not. Half the surrounding low hills were covered with squat, gnarled olive trees, dappled by the sunlight, where lancers already rode along the rows to make sure they were clear. There was no sign of workers in those orchards, no farmhouse, no structure of any kind in sight. A few miles to the west, the hills were darker, forested. Legion men, emerging in trotting files below Rand, formed up, trailed by a ragged square of Ilianer volunteers, now enlisted into the Legion. As soon as their ranks were aligned, they marched out of the way to make room for defenders and companions. The ground seemed mostly clay, and boots and hooves alike skidded in a thin skim of mud. For a wonder, though, only a few clouds hung in the sky, white and clean. The sun was a pale yellow ball, and nothing flew up there larger than a sparrow. Dashiva and Flynn were among the men holding gateways, as were Adli and Hopwill, Moore and Narishma. Some of the gateways lay out of Rand's sight, behind the folded hills. He wanted everyone through as quickly as possible, and except for a few soldiers scanning the sky, every man in a black coat who was not already out scouting held a weave. Even Gedwin and Rochide, though both grimaced over it, at each other and in his direction. Rand thought them no longer used to doing anything so common as holding a gateway for others to use. Bashir cantered up the slope, very much at ease with himself, and with his short bay. His cloak was flung back despite the morning's coolness, not so cold as the mountains, but still wintry. He nodded casually to Anayila and Ailil, who gave bleak stares in return. Bashir smiled through those thick mustaches like down-curving horns, a not entirely pleasant smile. He had as many doubts of the women as Rand did. The women knew, about Bashir's reservations at least. Turning her head quickly from the Saldaean, Anayila returned to stroking her gelding's mane. Ailil held her reins too rigidly. That pair had not strayed far from Rand since the incident on the ridge, even having their tents pitched in earshot of his the night before. On a brown grass hillside opposite, Denharad shifted to study the two noblewomen's retainers, arrayed together behind him, then quickly returned to watching Rand. Very likely he watched Ailill, and maybe Annihila as well. But he watched Rand without doubt. Rand was unsure whether they still feared to take the blame if he was killed, or simply wanted to see it happen. The one thing he was certain of was that if they did want him dead, he would give them no opportunity.
"Who knows a woman's heart?" Luz Theron chuckled wryly. He sounded in one of his saner moods. "Most women will shrug off what a man would kill you for, and kill you for what a man would shrug off."
Rand ignored him. The last gateway in Rand's sight winked out. The Ashaman mounting their horses were too far for him to say for sure whether any still held on to Saideen, but it did not matter so long as he did. Clumsy Dashiva tried to mount quickly, and nearly fell off twice before successfully reaching his saddle. Most of the black-coated men in view began riding north or south. The rest of the nobles gathered quickly with Bashir on the slope, just below Rand, the highest ranking, and those with the most power in front, after a little jostling here and there, where precedence remained uncertain. Tahara and Markalin kept their horses on the fringes, on opposite sides of the mass of nobles, faces carefully blank. They might be asked for advice, but both knew the final decisions rested with others. Wireman opened his mouth with a grand gesture, doubtless to begin another splendid peroration on the glories of following the Dragon Reborn. Sunaman and Torian, accustomed to his speeches and powerful enough to take no care around him, reined their horses together and began talking quietly. Sunaman's face wore an unaccustomed hardness, and Torian seemed ready to squabble over a boundary line, despite the red satin stripes on his coat sleeves. Square-jawed Bertome and some of the other Kyrianen were not quiet at all, laughing at each other's jokes. Everyone had had a bellyful of Wireman's grand declamations. Though Samaradrid's scowl deepened every time he looked at Ailill and Annihila, he did not like them remaining close to Rand, especially his countrywoman, so perhaps his sourness had more root than Wireman's windiness.
"About 10 miles from us," Rand said loudly, "a good 50,000 men are preparing to march."
They were aware of that, but it pulled every eye to him and silenced every tongue. Wireman's mouth snapped shut sourly. The fellow did love to hear himself talk. Guayam and Marakan, tugging at sharp-oiled beards, smiled in anticipation, the fools. Samaradrid looked like a man who had eaten an entire bowl of bad plums. Gregorin and the three lords of the Nine with him merely wore grim determination on their faces. Not fools.
"The scouts saw no signs of Suldam or Damani," Rand went on. "But even without them, even with Ashaman, that's enough to kill a lot of us if anybody forgets the plan."
"No one will forget, though, I'm sure."
No charges without orders this time. He'd made that clear as glass and hard as stone. No herring off because you thought maybe you just might have seen something either. Wireman smiled, managing to put as much oil into it as Sunaman ever could. It was a simple plan in its way. They would advance west in 5 columns, each with Ashaman, and attempt to fall on the Shan Chan from every side at once. Or as close to all sides as could be managed. Simple plans were best, Bashir insisted.
"If you won't be satisfied with a whole litter of fat piglets," he had muttered, "if you have to rush into the woods to find the old sow, then don't get too fancy, or she'll gut you."
"No plan of battle survives first contact," Luz Theron said in Rand's head. For a moment, he still seemed lucid. For a moment.
"Something is wrong," he growled suddenly.
His voice began to gain intensity and drift into wild, disbelieving laughter.
"It can't be wrong, but it is. Something strange. Something wrong. Skittering, jumping, twitching."
His cackles turned to weeping.
"It can't be. I must be mad."
And he vanished before Rand could mute him.
Burn him. There was nothing wrong with the plan, or Bashir would have been on it like a duck on a beetle.
Luz Theron was mad, no doubt of it, but so long as Randall Thor remained sane. A bitter joke on the world if the Dragon Reborn went mad before the last battle even began.
"Take your places,"
he commanded with a wave of the dragon scepter. He had to fight down the urge to laugh at that joke. The large clump of nobles broke apart at his order, milling and muttering as they sorted themselves out. Few liked the way Rand had divided them up. Whatever breaking down of barriers had occurred in the shock of the first fight in the mountains, they had sprung up again almost immediately. Wireman frowned over his undelivered speech, but after an elaborate bow that thrust his beard at Rand like a spear, he rode north over the hills, followed by Kirill Drapaneos, Bertome, Duresen, and several minor Kyrianan lords, every last one of them stony-faced at a tyrant being placed over them. Gedwin rode by Wireman's side, almost as if he were the one leading, and got dark scowls for it that he affected not to notice. The other groupings were as mixed. Gregorin also headed north, with a sullen Sunamon trying to pretend he was heading in the same direction by happenstance, and Althanas leading lesser Kyrianan behind. Jordwen Samaris, another of the nine, followed Bashir south, with Amondrid and Guayam. Those three had accepted the Saldaean almost eagerly, for the simple reason that he was not Tyran or Kyrianan or Ilianer, depending on the man. Rochide seemed to be trying the same with Bashir that Gedwin was with Wireman, but Bashir appeared to ignore it. A little way from Bashir's party, Torian and Marakon rode with their heads together, likely venting spleen at having Samaradrid placed over them. For that matter, Urshan Natari kept glancing toward Jordwin, and standing in his stirrups to look back toward Gregorin and Kirill, though it was improbable he could see them any longer past the hills. Samaradrid, his back iron rod straight, looked as unflappable as Bashir. It was the same principle Rand had used all along. He trusted Bashir, and he thought he might be able to trust Gregorin, and none of the others could dare think of turning against him, with so many outlanders around him, so many old enemies, and so few friends. Rand laughed softly, watching them all ride off from his hillside. They would fight for him, and fight well, because they had no other choice, any more than he had.
"Madness!" Luz Theron hissed.
Rand shoved the voice away angrily. He was hardly alone, of course. Tihera and Markalin had most of the defenders and companions mounted in ranks among the olive trees on hills flanking the one where he sat his horse. The rest were out as a screen against surprise. A company of blue-coated legionmen waited patiently in the hollow below under Masson's eye, and at their rear, as many men in what they had worn surrendering on the heath back in Ilion. They were trying to emulate the legionmen's calm, the other legionmen now, trying without a great deal of success. Rand glanced at Ailill and Anaela. The Tyran woman gave him a simpering smile, but it faltered weakly. The Kyrianan woman's face was frost. He could not forget them, or Denharad and their armsmen. His column, in the center, would be the largest and the strongest by a fair margin. A very fair margin. Flynn and the men Rand had chosen out from Dumai's Wells rode up the hill toward him. The balding old man always led, though all save Adlai and Arishma now wore the dragon as well as the sword, and Ashiva had worn it first. In part it was because the younger men deferred to Flynn, with his long experience as a bannerman in the Andoran Queen's guards. In part it was because Dashiva did not seem to care. He only appeared amused by the others. When he could spare time from talking to himself, it was. Most often he hardly seemed aware of anything past his own nose. For that reason, it was something of a shock when Dashiva awkwardly booted his slab-sided mount ahead of the rest. That plain face, so often vague or bemused with the fellow's own thoughts, was fixed in a worried frown. It was more than something of a shock when he seized Saidin as soon as he reached Rand and wove a barrier around them against eavesdropping. Luz Theron did not waste breath, if a disembodied voice had breath, on mutters about killing. He lurched for the source, snarling wordlessly, tried to claw the power away from Rand, and just as abruptly fell silent and vanished. "There's something askew with Saidin here. Something amiss," Dashiva said, sounding not at all vague. In fact, he sounded precise and testy. A teacher lecturing a particularly dense pupil. He even stabbed a finger at Rand. "I don't know what it is. Nothing can twist Saidin, and if it could be twisted, we'd have felt it back in the mountains. Well, there was something there yesterday, but so small. I feel it clearly here, though.
Saidin is eager. I know Saidin is not alive, but it pulses here. It is difficult to control.
Rand forced his hand to loosen its grip on the dragon scepter. He'd always been sure Dashiva was nearly as mad as Luz Theron himself. Usually the man maintained a better hold on himself, though, however precariously.
I've been channeling longer than you, Dashiva. You're just feeling the taint more.
He could not soften his tone. Light, he could not go mad yet, and neither could they.
Get to your place. We'll be moving soon.
The scouts had to return soon. Even in this flatter country, even limited to no further than they could see, 10 miles would not take long to cover traveling. Dashiva made no move to obey. Instead, he opened his mouth angrily, then snapped it shut. Shaking visibly, he drew a deep breath.
I am well aware how long you have channeled, he said in an icy, almost contemptuous voice. But surely even you can feel it. Feel, man! I don't like strange, applied to Saidin, and I don't want to die or be burned out because you're blind. Look at my ward. Look at it.
Rand stared. Dashiva pushing himself forward was peculiar enough, but Dashiva in a temper? And then he did look at the ward. Really look. The flows should have been as steady as the threads in tight-woven canvas. They vibrated. The ward stood solid as it should be, but the individual threads of the power shimmered with faint movement. Mor had said Saidin was strange near Ebu Dar, and for 100 miles around. They were closer than 100 miles now. Rand made himself feel Saidin. He was always aware of the power. Anything else meant death or worse. Yet he had become used to the struggle. He fought for life, but the fight had become as natural as life. The struggle was life. He made himself feel that battle, his life. Cold to make stone shatter into dust, fire to make stone flash to vapor, filth to make a rotten cesspit smell a garden in full flower. And a pulsing, like something quivering in his fist. This was not the sort of throbbing he had felt in Shadar Logoth, when the taint of Saidin had resonated with the evil of that place, and Saidin had pulsed with it. The vileness was strong, but steady here. It was Saidin itself that seemed full of currents and surges. Eager, Dashiva called it, and Rand could see why. Down the slope, behind Flynn, Moore scrubbed a hand through his hair and looked around uneasily. Flynn alternated shifting on his saddle and easing his sword in its scabbard. Narishma, watching the sky for flying creatures, blinked too often. A muscle twitched in Adli's cheek. Every one of them displayed some sign of nervousness and little wonder. Relief welled up in Rand. Not madness after all. Dashiva smiled, a twisted, self-satisfied smile. I cannot believe you didn't notice before. There was very close to a sneer in his voice. You've been holding Saidin practically day and night since we began this mad expedition. This is a simple ward, but it did not want to form. Then it snapped together like pulling out of my hands. The silver-blue slash of a gateway rotated open atop one of the bare hills, half a mile to the west, and a soldier pulled his horse through and mounted hurriedly, returning from the scout. Even at a distance, Rand could make out the faint shimmer of the weaves surrounding the gateway before they vanished. The rider had not reached the bottom of the hill before another gateway opened on the crest, and then a third, a fourth, more, one after another, almost as fast as the preceding man could get out of the way. But it did form, Rand said. So had the scout's gateways. If Saidin is hard to control, it's always hard. And it still does what you want. But why more difficult here? A question for another time. Light, he wished Herod Fell were still alive. The old philosopher might have had an answer.
Get back with the others, Dashiva,
he ordered. But the man stared at him in astonishment, and he had to repeat himself before the fellow let the ward vanish, jerked his horse around without a salute, and thumped the animal back down the slope with his heels.
Some trouble, my lord dragon?
Anaela simpered. Ailill merely looked at Rand with flat eyes. Seeing the first scout on the way toward Rand, the others fanned off to north and south, where they would join one of the other columns. Finding them the old-fashioned way would be faster than casting about with gateways. Drawing rein in front of Rand, Nalam slapped fist to chest. Did he look a bit wild-eyed? No matter. Sidine still did what the man wielding it made it do. Nalam saluted and gave his report. The Shanchan were not encamped 10 miles away. They were no more than 5 or 6 distant, marching east. And they had Suldam and Damani by the score. Rand issued his orders as Nalam galloped away, and his column began moving west. The defenders and the companions rode on either flank. The legion men marched at the rear, just behind Inharid. A reminder to the noblewomen and their armsmen, if they needed one. Anaela certainly looked over her shoulder often enough, and Ailill's refusal to was pointed. Rand formed the main thrust of the column, Rand and Flynn and the others, just as it would be with the other columns. Ashaman to strike, and men with steel to guard their backs while they killed. The sun still had a long way to climb before midday. Nothing had changed to alter the plan.
"Madness waits for some," Luz Theron whispered. "It creeps up on others."
Mirage rode near the head of his army marching east along a muddy road that wound through hilly olive groves and patchy forest. Not at the head. A full regiment, most Shanchan, rode between him and the forward scouts. He had known generals who wanted to be at the very front. Most were dead. Most had lost the battles they died in. Mud kept down dust, yet word of an army on the move ran like wildfire on the Salas Plains, whatever the land. Here and there among the olive trees he spotted an overturned wheelbarrow or an abandoned pruning hook, but the workers had vanished long since. Luckily, they would avoid his opponents as much as they did him. With luck, lacking Rakan, his opponents would not know he was on them until it was too late. Kenemiraj did not like trusting to luck. Aside from under-officers ready to produce maps or copy orders, and messengers ready to carry them, he rode accompanied only by Abeldar Yulan, small enough to make his quite ordinary brown gelding seem immense, a fiery man with the nails of his little fingers painted green, who wore a black wig to conceal his baldness, and Lysane Jarrath, a gray-haired woman from Shandar itself, whose pale plump face and blue eyes were a study in serenity. Yulan was not calm. Mirage's cold-dark captain of the air often wore a scowl for the rules that seldom let him touch the reins of a rakan anymore, but today his frown went bone-deep. The sky was clear. Perfect weather for rakan, but by Siroth's command none of his flyers would be in the saddle today, not here. There were too few rakan with the Hylene to risk them unnecessarily. Lysane's calm troubled Mirage more. More than the senior Der Suldam under his command, she was a friend with whom he had shared many a cup of kaff and many a game of stones. An animated woman, always bubbling over with enthusiasms and amusement. And she was icy calm, as silent as any Suldam he had tried to question. Within his sight were 20 Damani flanking the horsemen, each walking beside her Suldam's mount. The Suldam bobbed in their saddles, bending to pat a Damani's head, straightening only to bend again to stroke her hair. The Damani looked steady enough to his eye, but plainly the Suldam were on razor's edge. And a bullient Lysane rode silent as a stone. A Torm appeared ahead, racing down the column. Well off to the side, on the edge of the groves, yet horses whickered and shied as the bronze-scaled creature flowed past. A trained Torm would not attack horses, at least not unless the killing frenzy overtook it. The reason Torm were no good in battle, but horses trained to become around Torm were in as short supply as Torm themselves. Mirage sent a skinny under-lieutenant named Varek to fetch the Morat Torm's scouting report. Afoot, and the light consumed whether Varek lost sight there. He would not waste time on Varek trying to control a mount acquired locally. The man returned faster than he went, and made a crisp bow, beginning his report before his back was straight again.
"The enemy is less than 5 miles due east, my lord Captain General, marching in our direction. They are deployed in 5 columns, spaced approximately 1 mile apart."
So much for luck. But Mirage had considered how he would attack 40,000 with only 5 himself, and 50 Damani. Quickly, men were galloping with others to deploy to meet an attempted envelopment, and the regiments behind him began turning into the groves, Suldam riding among them with their Damani. Gathering his cloak against a sudden cold wind, Mirage noticed something that made him feel colder still. Lysane was watching the Suldam vanish into the trees, too, and she had begun to sweat. Vertome rode easily, letting the wind stream his cloak to one side, but he studied the forested country ahead with a wariness he barely attempted to conceal. Of his four countrymen at his back, only Duresin was truly skilled in the game of houses. That fool Tyran dog Wireman was blind, of course. Vertome glared at the puffed-up buffoon's back. Wireman rode well ahead of the rest in deep conversation with Gedwin, and if Vertome needed any further proof that the Tyran would smile at what gagged a goat, it was how he tolerated that hot-eyed young monster. He noticed Kirill glancing sideways at him and reined his gray further from the towering man. He had no particular enmity toward the Ilianer, but he did hate people looming over him. He could not wait to return to Kyrian, where he did not have to be surrounded by ungainly giants. Kirill Drapaneus was not blind, though, however overtall. He had sent a dozen scouts forward, too. Wireman had sent one.
Duresin, Vertome said softly. Then a little louder.
Duresin, you lump! The bony man gave a start in his saddle. Like Vertome, like the other three, he had shaved and powdered the front of his head. The style of marking yourself like a soldier had become quite fashionable. Duresin should have called him a toad in return, the way they had since boyhood, but instead he heeled his gelding up beside Vertome's and leaned close. He was worried and letting it show, his forehead furrowed deeply.
"You realize the Lord Dragon means us to die," he whispered, glancing at the column trailing behind them. "Blood and fire, I only listened to Kolaver, but I have known I was a dead man since he killed her."
For a moment, Vertome eyed the column of armsmen, snaking back through the rolling hills. The trees were more scattered here than ahead, but still enough to shield an attack until it was right on top of you. The last olive grove near nearly a mile behind. Wireman's men rode at the fore, of course, in those ridiculous coats with their fat white-striped sleeves, and then Kirill's Ilianers in enough green and red to shame tinkers. His own people, decently clad in dark blue beneath their breastplates, were still beyond his sight, with Duresin's and the others, ahead only of the company of legionmen. Wireman had seemed surprised that the foot kept up, though he had hardly set a difficult pace. It was not really the armsmen Vertome glanced at, though. Seven men rode before even Wireman's, seven men with hard faces and death-cold eyes, in black coats. One wore a pin in the shape of a silver sword on his tall collar. "An elaborate way to go about it," he told Duresin dryly, "and I doubt Althor would have sent those fellows with us if we were just being fed into a sausage grinder." Forehead still creased, Duresin opened his mouth again, but Vertome said, "I need to talk to the Tyran." He disliked seeing his childhood friend this way. Althor had unhinged him. Absorbed in one another, Wireman and Gedwin did not hear him riding up on them.